I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. President Trump told Fox News on Tuesday he wants the economy to get back to normal by Easter. That's just a few weeks away.
I'd love to have it open by Easter. Okay, I would love to have it open by Easter. I will tell you that right now. I would love to have that. It's such an important day for other reasons, but I'll make it an important day for this, too. I would love to have the country opened up and just raring to go by Easter.
This announcement puts the country on a collision course with public health experts who say that staying home and shuttering businesses is critical to slowing the spread of coronavirus, protecting the vulnerable, and the healthcare system. Trump has claimed the country would lose more people from a deep recession or depression than from COVID-19. Tom Inglesby, he's the head of Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, said abandoning public health restrictions would be irresponsible and dangerous. Joining us is Philip Bump. He's national correspondent for The Washington Post and has been covering the White House response to the coronavirus. And Philip Bump, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Of course.
Does the president have any authority to send people back to work?
Well, I mean, what we're operating on now is there's this sort of national recommendation that people stay separated, that businesses closed to some extent, but most of the actual effects of that in the state-by-state level are imposed by governors of various states. So it's, you know, Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York and Governor Wolf in Pennsylvania, who are the ones who have said, hey, actually, we're going to impose these restrictions right now. So Trump certainly can offer some guidance, but it really will come down to whether or not governors in the end feel as though this Easter timeline is something worth respecting.
Why does he care so much about the economy? And I ask that knowing, of course, many people are suffering, including workers and business owners. But that seems so central to the president.
No, it really does. And it has from the outset of this. I mean, people may remember that up until basically a week ago Monday, President Trump was suggesting that all of this would sort of wash away and that we didn't need to take any significant actions in order to try and curtail the virus. It was eventually impressed upon him, in part because of a study showing how bad the scale of a pandemic could be, that we needed to have these measures to try and and do social distancing and all these various things aimed at curtailing the spread of the pandemic. Once that was impressed upon him, he advocated for these policies, but clearly his heart is with, let's just get things back to normal. Whether or not he understands that the economy will be driven by whether or not hospitals are overflowing and people are dying at massive scale from this virus is something that remains undetermined.
Well, we know that every president is judged about the economy, the state of the economy, and when they're running for re-election, that's often how voters decide who they're going to vote for. And, of course, we're in the middle of an election season, such as it is, but this seems to be of such import to the president.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, certainly this is something that he understands well. He comes from the world of business. He understands what it means to have, for example, a business shutdown and not taking in any clients. His businesses currently, as the Post has reported, are not operating, and that's costing the Trump organization money. You know, whether or not that's actually driving his concern is one thing, but he certainly is aware of what the ramifications of that are. But you're exactly right. It seems pretty obvious that President Trump is sort of hoping that something will arrive, a deus ex machina, and it will just sort of appear, like, you know, maybe it's a particular drug that can solve all of these cases, and then we can just start going about our business. There's no indication that's going to happen. This is something that may be problematic for months, you know, 12 to 18 months until there's a vaccine could be the issue, which health experts have been repeatedly saying. But it is certainly the case that Donald Trump has, since February, articulated this belief that maybe this can all just sort of go away and we can move forward. And now it seems as though he's going to take a bet that we can.
Well, and watching some of those coronavirus task force press briefings, I mean, it's interesting and important to hear what people have to say, but I think equally important is watching body language and, you know, how the various people standing on the stage very closely, I should add, how they are responding to what whoever is at the dais is saying.
No, that's absolutely right. And obviously people have put a lot of attention on Dr. Fauci, who is sort of the face of the government expert response here to a large extent. And he at times has sort of expressed physically some consternation with the things that President Trump is saying. He's in a tough spot. I mean, President Trump is his boss, and he is instructed to do what the White House wants him to do. But he, I think, recognizes, and this seeps out into some of the interviews that he done that he does, he recognizes that President Trump's approach is not the, necessarily the approach that he would recommend in order to maximize the extent to which we're able to deal with this virus. And I think part of the challenge is we've been undergoing for a week, 10 days, this broad national plan to try and limit the number of cases, but we're still seeing a very big increase. I live in New York State. We're seeing a huge increase in the number of cases in New York State, and President Trump seems to just sort of be pushing that to the side, suggesting that perhaps it's somehow anomalous and, you know, it's not a threat to the rest of the country, and health experts are saying that's not the case.
I do want to play one more clip and get your response to this, Philip Bump. And this is actually the president at a press conference on Monday where he was comparing the threat of coronavirus both to the flu and also to car crash deaths. Let's give that a listen and then we'll come right back to you.
We have a very active flu season, more active than most. It's looking like it's heading to 50,000 or more deaths, not cases. 50,000 deaths, which is, that's a lot. And you look at automobile accidents, which are far greater than any numbers we're talking about. That doesn't mean we're going to tell everybody no more driving of cars. So we have to do things to get our country open.
And I think we've heard those arguments even from other people as well, Philip Bupp. Why don't they stand up?
Well, take, for example, what he just said about cars, that the number of automobile deaths, which is about 40,000 a year, is far greater than anything we're talking about. We don't know what we're talking about. That's the problem, right? COVID-19 is spreading very quickly. It's spreading much more rapidly than the flu, and it has a higher mortality rate than the flu. Even if it's not at the 3% that the WHO said a month or so ago, even if it's 1%, that's 10 times as many people who contract the virus are going to die than with the seasonal flu. And so the challenge is when we're comparing something like car crashes to COVID-19, first of all, we don't actually know if that comparison is valid. There are some estimates which could put the number of COVID-19 deaths over multiple seasons over a million people, right, assuming that we don't take significant actions to address it. But secondarily, what we're talking about is the rate of increase. If we saw car accidents, the number of car accident fatalities double over the course of a week and then double again over the course of another week, we absolutely would stop and say, hey, what's going on with cars, and introduce new restrictions on when and how people are driving. The rate of increase is the thing that we're concerned about in this moment, and that's why a comparison to cars in particular falls flat.
And with the flu, and we know, of course, seasonal flu does kill thousands of people, but it is a known virus. There is a vaccine for it. We kind of know what we're talking about. With corona, we don't.
That's exactly right. And that point that the coronavirus, the particular virus that we're dealing with now, which is newly emergent over the course of the last 6 months or so, means that there isn't anyone in the community who has any antibodies for it, that it's not part of any sort of vaccination process. One of the ways in which we control the seasonal flu is by people getting flu shots and by the fact that some people have had it before, and so they have antibodies for it. None of that exists here, and that's part of the reason why the spread is so broad and so fast, and why it's not fair to simply say, well, you lose tens of thousands of the flu each year. This is different. And again, we don't know what the scale of the effect of it will be.
There was even, I believe the lieutenant governor of Texas was talking about sort of saying to older people, you know, perhaps you should be willing to sacrifice yourself for the good of the rest of the country. I mean, that doesn't hold up either, but it's out there now.
Right. I mean, beyond the ghoulishness of that sort of sentiment, which is, you know, not limited to Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick in particular, it is also the case that this affects a lot of people who are under the age of 60. There was a research done by the Kaiser Family Foundation found over 100 million people in the country are either older or have existing health conditions, and about 25 million people under the age of 60 have pre-existing health conditions, which may make them at added risk. We're seeing, I think this is off the top of my head, but I think something like 40% of the cases in New York State were people who were under the age of 60 who ended up in the hospital. So this is something that very much affects younger people. We sort of had this perception that, well, this is the most risk is to older people, which is true, but there is still risk to younger people, and that's another reason why if we get everyone out and working, and this spreads even among people who are under the age of 60, there's going to be a huge effect because we can still end up overwhelming hospitals. We can still end up limiting the effect of, you know, have a lot of people who are out sick, it doesn't matter how old they are, it's still going to affect their bottom line.
But what we're seeing, and perhaps this will change over time, is a real partisan response to what public health people are saying about the risk of coronavirus, with Democrats, frankly, taking it more seriously, Republicans being more dismissive. But now we've got Senator Rand Paul, who tests positive for COVID-19. He apparently was at the Senate gym and palling around with some of the members of Congress, which raises a whole host of questions, Philip.
No, that's
and
right.
He's a doctor, we should say.
Right. No, that's especially true because the risk is higher. There are, you are more likely, unfortunately, to die from the disease if you are older. The Senate is a very old institution, which obviously is not good. But to your point about partisanship, part of the reason why when a week ago Monday President Trump actually stood up and said, hey, this is bad and we need to take these measures, that was heartening in part because he had been telling his supporters, and he had been telling America broadly, but his supporters are more likely to trust his word, that it is basically no big deal and it would go away. That he has now backtracked on that concern and is now suggesting, hey, we're going to get through this and it'll be done fairly quickly, is problematic because I think, again, it suggests that his supporters may be more likely to be like, okay, cool, this is we're done, we're moving past this. Mm. Part of it, too, of course, is that because population density is heavier in cities and cities tend to be more Democratic and tend to be in, on the coast in more Democratic states, the effects in the redder parts of the country have been more limited than in bluer parts of the country. And so there may be less urgency simply because it's not as close to them geographically, although that, of course, is poised to change.
Well, and we know from these task force meetings that the president dominates them. I mean, he is the president of the United States. He gets to do that. But I know a number of news organizations are not carrying them live because of the amount of misinformation that we're getting from the president of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a question which has existed since the beginning and during the campaign in 2016. There's a lot of question, should we carry Donald Trump's rallies live because of what he says. In this particular circumstance, one of the challenges, I think, is that President Trump has spent a lot of time sort of making promises and offering assurances, which ended up very quickly not coming to fruition. So there's a difference between sharing misinformation and offering hope that doesn't manifest. And I think that we're seeing a lot of the latter here, and it raises real questions. Margaret Sullivan is a great columnist for the Post, wrote a very convincing piece about why we should be, loath to sort of just put it out there, in part because we see him saying, well, maybe we'll have this medicine which can cure this thing immediately, and that is just simply not what doctors are saying is likely to happen.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started. Philip Bump, thanks so much, and do stay safe out there. And you're welcome. And he is national correspondent for The Washington Post, has been covering the White House response to coronavirus. And we're going to take a very short break. And we're going to be talking about the pandemic of 1918, the lessons that we can learn from that, the lessons that were not learned. And we want to hear from you to join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can send us a message on our Facebook page. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. One of the questions we hear today is, have we ever faced a pandemic of this size and scope? Well, more than 200 years ago, when America was a young country and Philadelphia was the capital, yellow fever swept through the city, killing something like 5,000 people, about 10% of the population. In 1918, the Spanish flu, as it was called, killed 15,000 to 20,000 Philadelphians, many of whom were part of a big crowd watching a parade in Center City to raise bonds for the military. 700,000 Americans died from that virus, and more than 50 million succumbed to the disease worldwide. Since then, there have been other viral threats: MERS, SARS, Ebola, H1N1. Today on Radio Times, what we can learn from past public health crises to guide us through today's pandemic. And we have two guests who have joined us by phone. John Barry is the author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history, written about 10 years ago. He's a professor at Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. John Barry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Pat D'Antonio, and she's a professor of nursing and director of the Barbara Bates Center for the Study of the History of Nursing. That's at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. And Pat D'Antonio, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I do believe if history can be a guide, it can help us through some of these tough times. And again, to our listeners, to join the conversation, any questions or comments, you can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can leave a message on our Facebook page, and we will get you on the air. I've got my iPad open, and I'll be able to read your questions and your comments. Well, let's go back 100 years. And John Barry, if I can begin with you. What was the originator? Where did the Spanish flu, as it was called, where did it originate back in the turn of the 20th century?
Well, we're not sure, really, but we do know it was not in Spain. There are four hypotheses. In my book, I advanced rural Kansas, Haskell County. I thought I was reasonably convincing at the time, but a lot of research since then has made me doubt my own hypothesis. Right now, I think the leading likelihood is probably China, but France and Vietnam are also under consideration, you might say.
So still a question that we really don't have the answer to. Let me ask you, it is called the Spanish flu. Why is that?
Because Spain was not at war. So when the spring wave hit, it came in waves. The spring wave was pretty mild. The fall wave was really lethal. Then in the spring of 1919, there was a third wave, lethal by any standard except the second wave. At any rate, in the spring, the king got sick. A lot of Spaniards got sick. Their newspapers wrote about it, and the warring countries had a censored press. In the U.S., it was self-censored. And they did write about the outbreaks in Spain. It became known as the Spanish flu.
Wow. Is there a better name we could use today?
I don't know. My book, I just referred to it as influenza or pandemic or something. It's got that name, so we may as well stick with it.
Something I guess we can all understand, although it's important to know that it did not originate from Spain as far as we know. Just one more question to you, John Barry, before we get Pat D'Antonio into the conversation here. This was around, the First World War is coming to an end. You've got soldiers coming home from the war. There's a lot of movement. There's a lot of travel. There's a lot of dislocation. How did that spread this virus?
Well, it did spread it, but I think people need to understand that the war was not a huge factor in the spread. It would have gotten pretty much everywhere anyway. In the 1600s, managed to have an influenza pandemic move from Europe to North America, when it took weeks to cross the ocean. Second only to, or third, I guess, smallpox was number one in killing Native Americans. Mm-hmm. Measles and influenza were just about tied for second. So you don't need air travel or even steamships and railroads to move the disease. But the war may have accelerated slightly the movement, but it would have happened anyway.
I mean, you need people, though, right? You need people to bring it.
You do need people, sure. But again, there have been other pandemics, at least 11 in the last 300 years. And most of them, of course, long before we had modern transportation. It gets around. It's a very, very contagious disease, and it moves rapidly.
Jeremy, I'll get back to you. Pat D'Antonio, let me get you in on the conversation. And we're talking about the great pandemic, or the pandemic of 1918-1919. Thinking about Philadelphia, but also just thinking about the rest of this country, did we understand viruses back then? Did we know what a virus was?
We did, but it was only a very beginning understanding. This was the time when we were beginning to expand our knowledge of bacteria and how to produce vaccines in particular to prevent bacteria. So our knowledge of bacteria was much more developed. Knowledge of vaccines, we knew about viruses, but we were still struggling to try to figure out how to treat them and how to develop vaccines against them, which was then the number one public health measure that we could deploy.
What did we know about viruses 100 years ago?
What we knew is that you could treat, and you could treat with excellent nursing care. The fevers you could treat with cooling baths. We knew we needed to keep patients well hydrated, well fed. We knew we needed to keep them as restful as we could. We knew we needed to keep them in spaces that had adequate circulation of air, good ventilation, so that they wouldn't be exposed to any other kinds of infectious diseases. And we knew we needed to give them and their families emotional support. We knew we needed nurses to take care of these patients. We could not cure them, but we could, with any kind of medical treatment, but we could cure them with good nursing care.
This was, I guess, the early days of public health. We were putting in, you know, plumbing and helping to create a much more sanitary country. Did we know 100 years ago, Pat, about washing hands and hygiene and those ways of trying to limit the spread of a virus such as this?
Yeah, I would say. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Pat, and then Sean, I'll get you. We're all at home on our phones and trying to manage everything. Let me first start with you, Pat, and then John will get you in on the conversation. Go ahead, Pat.
We knew all about the effectiveness of those kinds of interventions in 1918. In fact, we had a very well-developed public health system, and we had a very well-developed system of public health nurses at the time. We had nurses already highly skilled and highly experienced with delivering messages to people about don't share utensils, don't share drinking cups, wash your hands, cover your mouth when you cough. A lot of this developed in interventions that were designed to eliminate the spread of TB, tuberculosis, which was then one of the leading infectious diseases in the country. And everyone immediately recognized we had to mobilize the same kind of public health teaching, public health interventions against the flu. And it was nurses who were in the vanguard of taking that messages into the homes of people across Philadelphia and across the country. The other thing to remember in 1918, though, that was very different than the situation we have today, is hospitals were not the center of the healthcare system. Healthcare treatment at home was still the preferred method of treatment. And it was nurses who were deployed and were very skilled at bringing their care and their treatment and their messages into the homes of people across the country.
John Barry, I know you want to add something. Go ahead.
Well, I would say that's completely right on that. Interestingly, medical education for doctors had been backward. It was just undergoing a revolution in the early 1900s, whereas scientific education of nurses was actually quite a bit better than the average medical school in the late 19th and very early 20th century. In terms of viruses, they weren't sure whether a virus was just a really, really small bacteria. They referred to it as what was called filterable virus, which meant it would pass through the smallest filters they had. They didn't know if it was a different kind of organism. That actually knowledge developed in research that came out of the influenza pandemic around 1925. They actually figured out that it was a different kind of organism, not just a really small bacteria. There was a lot of scientific advances that came out of the influenza pandemic, including the discovery that DNA carried the genetic code.
Let me just add that
John is absolutely right. Nursing education at that point, the key difference is that nursing education at that point took place in hospitals. And what that meant was that nurses knew how to work with patients. And that medical education at that point, by and large, did not include actual experiences with patients. So nurses were the ones that had the experience of how do you talk to patients, how do you convince someone who really didn't want to eat anything that this broth was really helpful and really nourishing. How do you convince a young adult, a teenager, that, yeah, they really had to stay in a room by themselves? Nurses had that on the ground, on the site clinical experience.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We are talking about the lessons that were learned and not learned from the influenza pandemic of 1918 and 1919. That's Pat D'Antonio. She's a professor of nursing, director of the Center for the Study of the History of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, joining us by telephone. Also, John Barry with us as well. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History. And he's currently a professor at Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. And I can see comments are coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, and we'll try to get you to be part of this conversation. Let me talk in some specific detail, and I'll start with you, John Barry. Just what were the symptoms of the Spanish flu? What did it look like? Of course, thinking about what we're dealing with today, but what did it look like 100 years ago?
Well, the overwhelming majority of people had exactly what we have today, the same symptoms. But in some cases, the symptoms could be pretty horrific. It was initially misdiagnosed as dengue, cholera, typhoid. To give you a sense of those symptoms, dengue is referred to as breakbone fever. So, I mean, real aches and pains. Some of the other symptoms were even more horrific. People could turn so dark blue from lack of oxygen that in the book, I quote one Army doctor writing a colleague saying that he couldn't distinguish African-American soldiers from white soldiers because their pallor was so similar.
Wow.
That, of course, spread rumors of the Black Death. And you could actually bleed not only from your nose and mouth. In fact, nosebleed in some army camps in many is 15% of the cases. But you could also bleed from your eyes and ears, which is a pretty frightening symptom.
And my understanding is that the victims, this is, of course, 100 years ago, were largely 18 to 45. Of course, people didn't live as long as
Correct.
They do now. But is that pretty true, John Barry?
Yeah, the well over 90% of the excess mortality was in people under 65 years old, which means that a virus similar to the 1918 virus must have circulated in their youth and given them natural immunity, but it had been so mild that there was basically no medical notice taken of that virus. 18 to 45 or 50 probably accounted for 2/3 of the dead. Age 28 was actually the peak of the highest proportion of the deaths was age 28. Pregnant women, multiple studies range from 21% to 71% case fatality for pregnant women.
I would also add, the demographics of who was dying. Being young adults is, you know, from the perspective of the healthcare clinicians who were taking care of these patients, and I'm talking doctors, nurses, healthcare, Red Cross volunteers, this is what also made it particularly terrifying for them as well, because that was their age group. And they knew quite well that they were going in to take care of these kinds of young adults that they could identify with and from whom they could catch the virus, the flu, from as well. And they were well aware of the dangers that were involved and continued to serve. So a shout out to all of them in 1918 and now who are still going in every day and taking care of these kinds of patients.
Absolutely. And that can't be said enough. Pat, I know 100 years ago, we're talking about in Philadelphia, the Archbishop called on nuns to volunteer to help. Mm-hmm. Obviously not trained as nurses, but I read that something like 2,000 of them said, we're here to help. 2,000.
They did. And we have wonderful oral histories of their service, which is a big source of information that we have now about what it was like to nurse these kinds of patients. And that's what we do see, whether we're talking yellow fever, the flu, even the emergencies that are caused by World War I and World War II, is this kind of collapsing of boundaries among different groups. What is it appropriate for physicians to do? What is it appropriate for trained nurses to do? What can lay people step in and do? Which is something that we will probably see now in the coronavirus epidemic we're experiencing. Mm. There is a real shifting of who's doing what because you need the most skilled clinicians in the situations that called for the highest level of care.
John Barry, let me read a couple of emails. One from Anne. She said, I would not be here without the 1918 flu pandemic. My maternal grandmother was living on Coney Island when her entire family was stricken. She lost her husband and two young children, but survived. She went on to remarry my grandfather. An email from Pam says, my grandmother was a Navy nurse in World War I. At the end of the service, she had patients affected by the flu. She kept a diary during that time, and almost all of her patients died. Perhaps she was protected by from having the flu when it first came through the area. These are really just such poignant stories.
It was an incredibly difficult time.
And I would just add that, I mean, it is a poignant story. I would love to see that diary. One of the things that we know about nurses is they often don't see what they do as heroic. Mm-hmm. And as worthy of being recorded and written down for future generations. I'm delighted there is a diary because we need these stories about what people are doing in these disasters. And we need people who are working with our patients, with our families, to take very seriously the heroism of what they're doing and to make sure future generations know it as well.
No question. We'll figure out how to get some diaries, if not to you, to others as well. We're talking about the great pandemic of 1918-1919 and what we can learn and apply for today. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm at home, as many of you are. We're talking about what we can learn from the pandemic of 1918-1919 that we can apply to today. And again, our guests are Pat D'Antonio. She's a professor of nursing, director of the Barbara Bates Center for the Study of the History of Nursing. That's at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. I'm okay. I just caught a little cough in my throat. John Barry, also with us by telephone, author of The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, and he's a professor at Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. And again, we want to hear from you, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, I've kind of buried the lead here, and John Barry, if I can go back to you, and let's talk about Philadelphia. Philadelphia is something like 15,000 to 20,000 people died from the pandemic of 1918-1919. Is that about right?
Right. One of the hardest hit cities in the country. It was also one of the most corrupt political machines in the country. In fact, it was so corrupt that a senator, the state elected a U.S. senator, came out of that machine a few years later, and the U.S. Senate, controlled by that person's own party, refused to seat him. That's how corrupt it was. And that played into what happened during the pandemic. The public health commissioner was very late in taking any action. They lied to the public about the seriousness of the pandemic. In fact, when they, and these lies were echoed by the press. In fact, when the when they finally closed schools, banned public gatherings, closed bars, restaurants, theaters, church services, one of the newspapers actually said, this is not a public health measure. You have no cause. for alarm. So
wow.
Obviously, go ahead.
No, I was going to say there's a cautionary lesson there. Let me just do a quick follow-up here. And it seems there was this critical parade or a parade that was set up to raise money for the military, some bonds. Of course, many people came out to see the parade. How critical was that for then the deaths that followed?
Well, influenza was already rampant in the city. And the entire medical community pretty much advised canceling the parade. They told reporters this. Reporters wrote stories. Editors wouldn't print them. The parade went forward. Several hundred thousand people, Liberty Loan parade, and, you know, like clockwork, 48 to 72 hours later, the disease exploded, which is the incubation period for influenza is about 1 to 4 days. Most people get sick after about 48 hours. You know, the disease just exploded in the city.
In fact, I read on one day, I think it was October 10th, something like 759 people in Philadelphia died from influenza, correct?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the result, of course, it was frightening anyway, under the best possible circumstances. But when the public was being lied to so blatantly, trust broke down. And not only between the public and the authorities and the press, but also between each other. Nobody knew what to believe, and I believe, and the unknown is in the your imagination is actually sort of the scariest. If you go to a horror movie, it's always scarier before the monster appears on the screen.
Exactly.
That suspense, you don't know what's waiting for you. That is the most frightening part. And not knowing what they were facing really led, in some ways, not to overstate it, but almost to certainly a fraying of a society, almost a disintegration. Let me read to you something who was seeking. This was a person in Philadelphia who was in charge of volunteer efforts. She kept calling for volunteers in the paper, and then she finally turns contemptuous, said, quote, "Hundreds of women who are content to sit back had delightful dreams of themselves in the roles of angels of mercies, had the vanity to imagine they were capable of great sacrifice. Nothing seems to rouse them now. They've been told there are families in which every member is ill, in which children are actually starving because there is no one to give them food. Still, they hold back." Same token, the police department was asked for 4 volunteers to move bodies out of homes where they were decomposing, and 114 police officers showed up. So there was actually a lot of courage shown as well, just as earlier Pat was talking about the nurses facing, you know, real risk and knowing they were taking risk, and many, many nurses and doctors died. But other parts of the community did stand up, like the police. But by and large, the community most was on the verge of falling apart.
Sure.
One of the things.
Yeah, Pat. I'm trying to imagine, you know, being a nurse or being a nurse. You're a historian of nursing. What it was like to try to manage that amount of, frankly, death. And that amount of just disease and illness and just sort of the fraying of society.
Yeah, one of the things that we have at the Bates Center is a scrapbook that someone kept of newspaper articles that were published in Philadelphia while this pandemic was evolving and then exploding, when people didn't know the outcome. I mean, one of the things as historians, when we go back to an event, we know what happens. So it's just a really incredible source of how people were trying to make sense of what was absolutely inconceivable numbers of death, of sickness, of not being able to find any kind of resources. And, you know, comments like the one John just read, is an example of something else was going on. A lot of the responses were also framed by what kind of role in society you had, what kind of class you came from. Are you mobilizing your traditional upper-class philanthropic women to come out, or are these women desperately trying to find nurses to come in to care for their own families? Sure. Where do, you know, the struggles that are going on at the time about what is more important, what you do for the public or what you do to protect your own family? These are very real, very personally felt struggles. One of the things that we can say about nurses is because of the norms at the time, many, if not most of them, were single women who didn't have the same kinds of struggles about do they care for themselves and their families or are they available to help their communities. The other thing we know that really did frame the nurses' response is, first of all, every city, not only Philadelphia, the plea was, please send us more nurses. Yeah. And there are never enough nurses in times of these kinds of pandemics. But of all the groups, we know nurses tended to have the closer ties to their own communities, whether it be a community of religion, a community of race, a community of different ethnic backgrounds. So they were also looking toward what were their needs of their particular communities. And the example of the nuns, I think, is a great example of how, in this case, the Catholic Church was looking to its own faith communities. So John is absolutely right. The social fabric was frayed. But very quickly, these other kinds of, I would call, communities of identity really looked to how they could step in, how they could first meet the needs of their own communities and then broaden their outreach to the community as a whole.
John, let me ask you about President Wilson. And there's some question, you wrote about this in your book, about whether he contracted this virus. He did become seriously ill. He was at the Paris Peace Conference, and there were some questions about just his mental health and his physical health. Help us understand what you think was happening with the president at the time.
Well, I don't think there's any question that he had a fairly severe case of influenza. It was rampant in Paris. One of the members, a younger member of the U.S. delegation, died. He had a temperature of 103, 104.
Wow.
You know, the violent coughing, you know, basically every symptom, along with some abdominal symptoms, which in that, in 1918, was not unusual at all for influenza. In a comprehensive study published in 1927, probably the classic study of the pandemic worldwide, they noted that second only to pulmonary complications were mental disorders, mental complications. Whether the virus somehow crossed the blood-brain barrier, I don't know. Whether the immune system released many toxins, maybe they somehow affected it. I don't know the actual pathology, but it was very, very common for people to become disoriented, schizophrenic. The people whom Oliver Sacks wrote about in The Awakening, it's how he hypothesized that they were actually victims of the pandemic. At any rate, after he got sick, Wilson was clearly disoriented. Everybody commented on it. He couldn't remember what, you know, he was physically weak. He was mentally weak. Prior to his illness, he was adamant about sticking to the 14 points that the United States had supposedly gone to war over, certain principles. And after he got sick, he simply couldn't stand up to the French Prime Minister Clemenceau, whose nickname was the Tiger, and he ended up giving in on basically everything. John Maynard Keynes.
International implications. Let me just do one more thing, because I read a couple of interviews that you have done about your book and about the current pandemic, about the importance of the government telling the truth, of being honest to people who are either afraid or confused or don't understand the seriousness of a pandemic. I just want to have you double down on that because that's so critical for today.
Yeah, it is. I mean, is what happened in Philadelphia and many other cities when people were being lied to was a drain of society. There was a dean of the University of Michigan Medical School became during the war head of the communicable diseases for the Army. And he wrote privately that if this rate of acceleration continues a few more weeks, civilization could disappear from the face of the earth. That's how bad things were getting at their worst. He could see that coming. Things did not continue to accelerate. The corner was turned just about the time he wrote that. But in the few cities where the leadership actually told the truth, they functioned much better. In most disasters, communities come together. People come together and help each other. That was not happening in many places in influenza. But in San Francisco, let's say first in Philadelphia, they were saying things like, quote, this is ordinary influenza by another name, unquote. But in San Francisco, the mayor, the business community, labor leaders, the health professionals, came together, signed a joint statement, full page in newspapers, huge type, said, wear a mask and save your life. Yeah. Now, they didn't know the masks weren't going to work, and they didn't work. But that is a very different message than this is ordinary influenza by another name. The false reassurance didn't work. San Francisco functioned much better than any other city that I know of. When they closed schools, teachers volunteered at everything from ambulance drivers to telephone operators. At the end of the outbreak, the newspaper wrote an editorial praising the city's performance, saying that it would, as terrifying as it was, it would go down in San Francisco in history as one of the most glorious moments of the city because of the way it came together. You couldn't write that about Philadelphia.
Well, and something to keep in mind for today. Pat, let me read a couple of more comments, and I'm watching the clock here. Joe says, our grandmother lost her healthy 20-year-old son to this flu, yet no stories have come down to us about this shattering loss. An email from Nina says, my mother was born in Brooklyn in 1918, and nothing was ever mentioned about the flu epidemic at the time of her birth. And perhaps, you know, in a strange and really sad way, this current pandemic is helping us understand this pandemic of 100 years ago and what can be learned, what we didn't learn, what we need to know, some of the important lessons from that pandemic of 1918.
That is such a great question. And it is a question that has fascinated historians. I never knew about this pandemic of 1918-1919 until I started studying history in graduate school. Wow. And so historians have tried to tackle why, after this absolutely horrific event, did we all seem so eager to forget it? The answer that I find most convincing is that immediately after the flu broke, immediately after we went back to normal, one of the things that happened is nothing else changed. We didn't change how we organized to public health to meet these kinds of emergencies or pandemics. Hmm. We didn't change how we connect with each other in social communities. We didn't change how we would educate our children. So there was not a lot of long-term social changes, and which Pat, allowed the opportunity to forget.
Sure, and I hate to step on your toes there, but I do thank both of you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. We certainly learned a lot. Pat D'Antonio, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And John Barry, thank you for joining us as well.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Yes, you do as well. And if you want to know more about the Philadelphia pandemic, you can check out The Why tonight on WHYY. Director of the Mutter Museum has put together an exhibit about the 1918 flu, and they'll be talking about it on The Why. Hope you can join us.